From the Missouri School of Journalism, welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. As the Islamic State nears defeat in Syria and Iraq, governments around the world are grappling with the question of what made such a brutal and violent terrorist organization attractive to so many foreign fighters. Nowhere is that question more pertinent than in the former republics of the Soviet Union. By some estimates, these countries were the source of more foreign fighters in Syria than any other region outside the Arab world. Now, this led to an extraordinary research and reporting project undertaken by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, a U.S. government-owned news outlet that reports on the region extensively. RFERL, as it's called, set out to examine three former Soviet republics in Central Asia that were the source of hundreds, probably thousands, of ISIS recruits. They wanted to find out why so many people left their home countries to fight in a foreign war, and what the prospects are for those who are returning now, as well as what happened to the people that they left behind. The result was a 40-minute documentary, as well as a series of reports and news broadcasts in local languages. Now, in these three countries that RFERL reported on, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan, this sort of discussion isn't easy to have. All three have mostly moderate Muslim populations, but the government in each of these countries tightly restricts any sort of public discussion on this issue. So on this special edition of Global Journalist, a close look at combating extremism in Central Asia, to tell us more about this project, which was called Not in Our Name, we're joined by one of the journalists who led it. With us now from Prague in the Czech Republic is Noah Tucker, a senior editor for Central Asia at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and the executive editor of the Not in Our Name project. Noah, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. These countries, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, not a lot is known. They're unfamiliar to people in many parts of the world. Give us just like a brief history about them since the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Well, their trajectories are parallel in a lot of ways to the other countries from the former Soviet Union. So they experienced really a complete collapse of their economy and their governance system in the early 1990s. And worked through a very long period of real economic struggle to try to right themselves and sort of rediscover themselves and the place that they occupied, even the cultural space that they occupied in the world at large. Each of the governments, to different degrees, has chosen officially democracy. In Kyrgyzstan, their democratic transition has been a little bit more complete than in the other two countries. In Kazakhstan and Tajikistan, Freedom House, for example, considers these consolidated authoritarian regimes, generally speaking, run by the same people who were running the country in the Soviet period under communism. So a lot has changed. But not so much has changed in terms of really the style of governance and the people who are themselves in power, in spite of everything else that has changed in the last 25 years.
Well, talk
years.
To us, if you would, about how many fighters are thought to have gone to fight in Syria from this region, from these specific countries over the past 6 years or so.
Well, from the whole region, we're looking at something around 5,000.
5,000. So this actually, is from like the broader five countries in Central Asia.
Yeah, from the broader region of Central Asia. And then if we look at the whole former Soviet Union, we get the largest number from any single region who went to fight in the Syrian conflict. And about half of all of those came from Central Asia. And in addition to that, a lot more people attempted to go than actually succeeded in getting to Syria. So somewhere on the order of 4 to 5 times as many. So this is a really remarkably large number of people that came as a surprise to a lot of analysts, myself included.
So 4 to 5 times. So I'm sorry. So just to be clear then, so it sounds like maybe as many as 40 or 50,000 people tried to go and fight, you know, something like a fraction of that number actually were successful. And those that went were either stopped in Turkey on their way there or somewhere else.
Right. Based on the numbers that we have from Turkish border police, it looks like at least somewhere on the order of 12,000 to 16,000 people tried to go who were stopped. So total numbers somewhere of those who attempted to go, maybe at least as many as 20,000.
Okay. Well, we should talk some about this documentary that you produced as part of this Not In Our Name project. In the documentary, you highlighted three sort of hotspot areas in Central Asia within these specific countries for ISIS recruitment, where we were talking about like cities or towns where there were a real high volume of people left to go fight in Syria. What are these areas? What do they have in common?
Well, they're very different from one another in a lot of ways, but they have some general things in common. One of them is that, you know, none of them are the poorest areas in these countries. You know, oftentimes we associate these things with sort of pure economic motivations, as if it would be people from the poorest or hardest hit areas would be going sort of out of pure economic desperation. That's not something that we find. What we find instead is places that have strong relative deprivation, where they used to do quite well, and now they are not. So the Jezkazgan region in Kazakhstan, for example, the area that we seem to have the largest number of recruits from a single area in Kazakhstan, used to be an extremely wealthy area. It's full of mineral resources, a place that has some of the world's richest, had at one time in the 20th century, some of the world's richest copper deposits, and just this incredible huge industrial effort constructed by the Soviet Union to exploit those copper deposits, and a fairly large city in the middle of the desert where we wouldn't expect a city to exist.
Okay, so that's interesting. So what you're saying is one of the things that they have in common is that people have seen sort of declining relative living standards, even if
yes,
by some measures they're still better off than other people, even yeah, in their own country.
Yeah, they've seen declining standards in each of these areas from how things used to be in the Soviet Union. And then they also have not advanced in the same way that some other areas in their own countries have. So within Kazakhstan, just to use them as an example again, we see very, very few people going from Astana and Almaty, you know, these really almost miraculously well-developed cities. Astana came out of the desert from nothing, and is really an incredible economic development project and a real success for Kazakhstan. But people in Jezkazgan look at that and see, in a lot of ways, many of them feel that they've been left behind, and they lack other mechanisms by which they can solve this conflict or change their prospects in life. And so they seem to be attracted to IS in particular as kind of a revolutionary organization, something that promises economic justice and justice in general, when they perceive their own situation to be sort of hopeless, but particularly being characterized by injustice.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. On today's program, we're talking about the Islamic State's recruitment of thousands of fighters from Central Asia, as well as why so many people left the region to fight in Syria, and what may become of them as they return home. We're joined by Noah Tucker, a senior editor for Central Asia at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. He helped lead an extensive months-long research and reporting project on the subject called Not In Our Name. One of the things they produced was a documentary on this issue in English, which you can watch on RFERL's website. And Noah, I want to talk a bit more about this documentary. It starts with this remarkable video of what looks like maybe a two-year-old boy named Omar. Now, he's a Kazakh boy, but he was born in Syria, I should say. And you hear him speaking on the video, like shouting these sort of slogans for the Islamic State, saying like, hey, my name is Omar Jihad. Talk to us about his family. I understand you interviewed his grandfather in this Jezkazgan region of Kazakhstan.
Yeah, this is a heartbreaking story. They're from a tiny village in the middle of the desert, and this family has lost their son, who's already been killed in the conflict, and lost contact with their daughter-in-law and three grandchildren who were taken along as a whole family to Syria. And the grandfather, Muhammad Kali, has made two trips to Syria from this tiny town to try first to convince his son to return and come home. And then after he learned his son was dead, he traveled again to Syria to try to bring back his
grandchildren. So he traveled right to the middle of a war zone to try to bring...
He did. He traveled to Raqqa the first time when his son was still alive to try to convince him to turn around and come home.
And I mean, I guess, you know, part of what stands out to me in this documentary was that how many families actually went, as in this case with Omar, was how many of these fighters went and brought their wives and children with them to live in Syria then. And that's something that was a broader phenomenon than I expected.
Yeah, and this is one of the other things that we would not expect when looking at the recruitment phenomenon from other areas. So, for example, you know, you have a large number of people who went from Belgium, France, the UK, but generally speaking, it's young men who travel on their own. And one of the things that stands out about Central Asia is that so many brought their entire families with them, including small children. In some of the families, the husband would leave first, and then the wife would follow after him and bring along the children and join them later. So it's a very deliberate process. And this is one of the other things that clues us into the idea that maybe people going from Central Asia thought they were getting into something a little bit different than what, say, recruits who came from France or from the UK thought that they were going to, and maybe part of what had informed their motives.
Well, let's shift now to Tajikistan. This is another one of the countries that you focused on. This is a country that, as I understand, is significantly poorer than Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan income per capita is something like 23,000, 24,000 a year, on the order of Russia. Tajikistan is much, much poorer. It has about 8 million people. I understand about 1.5 million of them are migrant or overseas workers, mostly working in Russia, and most of them are younger men. It sounds like actually a lot of recruitment of Tajiks who fought for IS actually happened while they were working overseas in another country, not in their home country.
Yeah, this is definitely a large factor in Tajikistan. The Tajik government itself argues that up to 90% of the people who were recruited were actually recruited while living in Russia. You know, we don't know exactly if these numbers are totally accurate, but it does seem to fit on the ground. And part of the reason for this is that a very large part of the generation of young Tajik men who are work eligible have left the country and are trying to work in Russia in areas where it's easier for recruiters to access them. And we know specifically that recruiters for the Islamic State and for Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups targeted migrant workers specifically. You know, we can't say exactly why, whether it's just because they had better access to them or it was easier to get to them, but they really made an effort to recruit among migrant laborers and target their messaging specifically to them and their political and economic grievances.
Well, you can, and I mean, it's obvious that in many ways these migrant workers, in some ways they're more sort of vulnerable while they're working in Russia. It sounded like from the documentary, many of them live fairly tenuous lives there.
Yeah, this is true. They definitely are in a difficult situation. The recruiting itself, you know, emphasizes this idea that, you know, you're in a country where nobody wants you, basically. You know, you're living every day with discrimination from Russian authorities. You're living with a sense of nationalism from the population that surrounds you. You have, you know, fairly poor economic prospects. There's no road for you to go back home. So we've created, you know, we have this great opportunity for you in Syria and in Iraq. We have a place where you belong, where you're not just you're not, it's not just a place you can be, it's a place where you can truly be a full citizen. And particularly with the recruiting for the Islamic State, there's a real emphasis on this being an opportunity to take revenge against the people that they blamed for all of the misfortunes.
Well, that's interesting because it doesn't sound like an explicitly religious pitch.
Or
exclusively religious.
Yeah. Yeah, before this project, I worked for a number of years analyzing, in particular, the recruiting messages that were used by Islamic State and Al-Qaeda-affiliated groups trying to draw Central Asians to Syria. And this is one of the first conclusions that that we drew, that it was a lot more about identity than it was about religion. There's very little actual religious content in a lot of the recruitment material. It's more about you are oppressed and you're oppressed because you're a Muslim. You know, it doesn't matter if you understand anything about Islam, if you've ever been to a mosque before, you know, if you're from Tajikistan, that means that you're a Muslim. And if you're oppressed at home and you're oppressed in Russia, you're being oppressed because you're a Muslim. And, you know, it's these enemies of Islam that you can go fight or defend yourself against in Syria or, you know, in some other cases, specifically the cases of the Islamic State. Here's your chance to get revenge. Here's your chance to kill instead of being killed, as they would put it, which is, of course, a false promise in a lot of ways. And much of the recruiting material is extremely deceptive and relies on misinformation and outright lies.
Well, let me ask you then about one of the Tajik women that you interviewed. I think her name was Shermo, and this is a woman living in Tajikistan whose brother went to Russia and then ended up getting recruited to IS while he was there. Give us their story.
Shermo is another really tragic story. A brother who's very close to her, who had to go and seek work in Russia. And she talks about how one day he called and said, it's time for me to get married. I want you to find me a wife. And she talks about how, you know, she and her mother went and found a woman who would agree to marry him. They performed the match. And then she took the bride into her home to live in together with her children and the rest of her family after her brother was married. And as her brother started to come back from Russia over the years, his attitudes started to change. He started to become very strict in his religious observance and started coming up with some kind of strange ideas about how they couldn't watch television or listen to music. And then one day he asked his sister he said, I found this great job in Turkey. I want you to send my sister, my wife and my children to come and live with me. And she talks, with tears streaming down her face, even now years afterwards, about how she used her own money to buy the ticket for her sister-in-law and their children who had lived and grown up with her. And she didn't know that she was actually sending them to Syria. Her brother was killed a few months later. And now the last communication that she had with her sister-in-law was just that she had been reassigned to another fighter and had become his wife. And now he forbids her from communicating with her family back in Tajikistan. And she's lost touch with them completely and has no idea what's happened to her or to the children that grew up in her house.
You're tuned into Global Journalist. We're talking today about Islamic extremism in the former republics of Central Asia, former Soviet republics of Central Asia, and why this part of the world was a source for so many foreign recruits for the Islamic State. We're joined from Prague by Noah Tucker of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. He leads an extensive research and reporting project on this issue called Not in Our Name. If you're interested in more Global Journalists, check us out online at globaljournalist.org. You can find our archives and additional coverage of underreported international news and human rights issues. Well, let's talk about Kyrgyzstan now. This is the third country that you researched as part of this project. You went to this region called Osh there, which was a hotspot for recruitment for the Islamic State. And this is a region where there had been some fairly significant ethnic violence in recent years. Talk to us about that and about what sort of the history of violence in this region may tell us about why people were so willing to join the Islamic State.
Yeah, one of the things that we found in all of the areas that we researched where there had been significant success in recruiting is that they each had something in their recent history that involved violence in the lives of the people who lived there. And in Kyrgyzstan, in the south, in Osh and the cities surrounding it and Jalalabad, there was a terrible ethnic conflict in 2010 that left around 10,000 people homeless and displaced, at least temporarily, over 100,000 residents. And the echoes of this conflict continue in a lot of ways up until today, particularly in the discrimination perceived by many ethnic Uzbeks who were on the losing end of this conflict, living in a Kyrgyz ethnic majority, Kyrgyzstan. And the overwhelming majority of recruits from Kyrgyzstan to the Syrian conflict have been ethnic Uzbeks. Many of them were recruited in Russia, similar to Tajiks, while they were seeking some kind of economic opportunity or to provide for their families or to escape the tense situation at home while they were in Russia.
Well, talk to us about how the governments of each of these countries, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, how have they reacted to this phenomenon? Clearly, it's something that they must be aware of and afraid of on some level.
Yeah, and you know, this is clearly a serious problem to have a significant number of people going to join a violent organization, a terrorist organization. It is definitely a security issue that that each state should deal with and has a responsibility to its citizens to deal with. So, you know, there's certainly no question about that for us or for our participants in the project. But one of the issues that we meet immediately is that for the governments in Central Asia, their understanding of this phenomenon is that it's rooted completely in religion. You know, that the issue is that people were maybe not really Muslim before, didn't understand a whole lot about their faith, and now they're vulnerable to becoming basically too Muslim. And that the way to fight this issue is not to talk about political issues or conflict or even in some cases the economic factors that have caused extreme labor migration, but to fight this by passing bans against different types of religious expression. So Tajikistan, for example, has been particularly notorious about enforcing an unofficial or extra legal ban on men having beards, for example, like mine, which is kind of a running joke in my travels in the region, but it is very serious. There are lots of young Tajik men who look like me, but with darker hair, who are, you know, pulled out of their jobs, pulled out of school, pulled out of their cars at checkpoints, and forced to go into barbershops.
So it sounds like the way that they're trying to react to this then is on sort of expressions of religion then, but they're not dealing with the issue of why, what the issues are that are driving people to move to a different country to join a violent terrorist group. Well, that's interesting because our time does grow short, but I want to ask you about some of these fighters and family members who are returning home now. I saw just recently in the past week or two, there was another group of Kazakhs who were sent back from Syria. I think it was 5-6 fighters, but most of them were women and children. How do people back in their home countries, how are they reacting to people who left to join the Islamic State?
Well, this is one of the things that we discussed a lot in the focus groups that we held with participants from all three of the countries, and I was really touched by the amount of empathy that all of the participants had, particularly towards children who have these tragic stories. You know, they don't get any choice about being taken to these war zones. And there was really overwhelming agreement among the participants that their governments have a responsibility for their citizens, and that children should not be punished for the mistakes of their parents. And to their credit, for example, the Kazakhstani government very recently has been working to cooperate with Iraqi authorities and with Kurdish authorities to bring back women and children from the war zone. Kazakhstan estimates that they have at least 500 children who still remain alive, trapped in Syria or in Iraq, and they're doing what they can to get them back. But the anguish that these families that we interviewed live with, you know, not knowing if their children are alive or dead, is really difficult. And the people around them have expressed a lot of empathy and support for them.
Well, talk to us then. Well, what about those who are actually participating in the fighting then? Are they facing jail time?
Right. For that, you know, this is a different issue. And the approach that was taken initially within the past couple of years by most of the countries in the region is to pass new legislation that gives them the right to annul the citizenship of anyone who leaves the country to fight in a foreign conflict somewhere.
So they lose their passport.
They lose their passport. And this has come, this has been a particularly controversial decision, both sort of among the public, among people that we interviewed, who felt like even if someone is a criminal, we're still responsible for them as citizens. But it's also come under fire from human rights organizations because it's a violation of a number of the UN charters that these countries are party to that says that you can't annul someone's citizenship unless they have dual citizenship with another country. You cannot leave someone as a stateless person. But this has been the way that initially the governments have preferred to deal with it. And they're not alone in that, to be fair. A number of European politicians have suggested, you know, similar measures. This is it's a difficult problem. And it's one that in particular is facing each of the countries in Central Asia now.
Well, our time grows short, but I wanted to ask you about sort of where you see this issue going in the future. The Islamic State, it does look like it's nearing defeat geographically, but still it seems like these same issues where you have disaffected young men, in particular men with families, it seems like the same root causes that caused them to go fight in Syria are still there. So won't they just go join another similar group that may form in the future if these causes aren't dealt with? Like, what's being done to address that?
Well, right now, not a whole lot, unfortunately. And this is one of the reasons why we felt like this project was important. I think what this surprising outflow of so many people from Central Asia who have no connection, no cultural and linguistic connection to Syria and to Iraq shows us is that there seem to be some really serious both economic and political problems that have driven them to this. And if we don't solve those, then the real danger, I think, for Central Asian countries is that instead of leaving, more citizens will decide to try to form these same kinds of groups at home and carry out attacks against their own government.
Well, we're out of time for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism and KBIA, Mid-Missouri Public Radio. Many thanks to Noah Tucker and Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, for their help in this program. The documentary Not in Our Name is available on the website rferl.org. Our producer this week is Rosemary Belson, with visual editor Grace Lett. Aaron Hay is audio engineer. Travis McMillan is director. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.